Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 65 of The Curious Realm. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for tuning in every week. This week, we are in a pre-recorded fashion. Unfortunately, I am not on the road for work this week. I am sitting at home recovering from some pretty massive oral surgery. So I'll be back with you next week. We should be bringing you the folks from the upcoming Texas Monsters and Legends show. Everyday Paranormal should be coming on the show to help promote that. We'll be having some great guests coming up after this commercial break. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can find all of our episodes. That's where you can stop by. Follow us on all the forms of social media that you find over on the right. You can also visit the Curious Realm store. Curious Realm store is where you can find all of the amazing books from our guests. That's where you can find all of our merch. That's where you can find the book from our guests that we are about to talk to right now. Dr. Simeon Hine is the author of Dark Matter Monsters, Cryptids, Ball Lightning, and the Science of Secret Life Forms. We will be talking with him about this book and some of that research right now. Good doctor, how are you today?
I'm good, Chris. Thanks for having me here today.
Absolutely. I'm excited to have you on because number one, I love talking to sociologists. That was one of my courses of study.
Yes.
In college, was sociology with an education concentration. So I was wanting to go out and teach and which is, I guess, a lot of the reason why I do this show.
Sure, I like to
expose people to new thought forms and new ways of thinking.
Yes.
And specifically new ways of looking at the phenomenology of phenomena.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And that's what it is. I try to explain to a lot of people, like, sure, we may get into some conspiracy theory, as people would talk it, even some tinfoil hat areas, what have you. But the whole reason is to demystify and clarify what is out there and help separate the truth from the myth. Because even whenever you're talking about ball lightning, other mm-hmm. life forms, cryptids, things like that, there is a truth in there.
Right.
Even if it is the perceived truth of the individual encounters that people have had.
Yes.
There is a truth in there. So let's begin with, how does a sociologist come to studying this kind of esoteric science?
Oh, thanks, Chris. Well, I'll tell you how it started with me. I studied fractal geometry.
Okay.
As a type of research method for looking at data sets. And as you know, fractal objects are objects that are mathematically branching, fractured, and between dimensions. It's literally the study of non-integer dimensional objects. And when you look at a data set that way, you're looking at it differently than you look at it from the ordinary statistical point of view, which is to fit everything to a line, a regression line. And when I was looking at fractal geometry and its sister science, chaos theory, I realized there were a lot of phenomena that we weren't looking at, even from a sociological point of view. At the time, I was looking purely at the idea of information quality, right? The idea that how do you know anything from your statistics? I'm a former statistics teacher. After I got my PhD, I ended up teaching statistics for a while. So I know what the limitations of statistics are. And we don't hear about these limitations very much. We're bombarded with analysis that tempts to sway our opinion one way or another every day, especially now since we're all exposed to social media.
Yeah.
But what I learned from fractal geometry is that reality does not fit to a line. There is no fundamental metric. It's an imaginary idea that you learned in school that we inherited from Greek science and so forth, going back thousands of years. But that's not how nature really works. And it started to open my mind to the idea that there could be phenomena between dimensions that don't fit into our ordinary way of thinking and talking about them, but they're still real. So it was from your phenomenological approach.
Interesting. Because, you know, one of the issues that I used to tell people literally stymied me for a long time in life was the fact that my brain thought too fractally. I would get caught in literally such a spiral of circular thought and reasoning inside of my own head and branches of possibilities that I would be brought to a point of literal indecision and immobility.
Oh, sure.
It wasn't even fight or flight. It was the third, the fight, flight, or freeze. That whenever it came to it, I would just, to think about fractal geometry and how it even relates to sociology and society as a whole, and how literally society splinters off and is a kind of a fractal in and of itself.
Right. The natural order of things is to be fractal, which means you're always going to have subgroups and more subgroups, and things are going to be split off. They're not always going to be unified, but they're still part of the same tree, even if they're on different branches. But what we should be aware of is the way we were thinking about reality is a distortion from the way it really works. And once I realized that, I began to be open to the idea that there could be things that could be real that I hadn't been taught about in school that could be between dimensions. Even Edwin Abbott wrote about that in that satirical book called Flatland, written in the 1880s, making fun of Victorian England, where he describes a society of beings living on a tabletop, a two-dimensional surface.
Yeah.
Right. And they encounter a sphere one day and they don't know what it is because it looks just like a circle opening and closing on the tabletop because they live on a tabletop surface. And when A Square gets arrested for saying that he saw a sphere from Sphereland, he finally realizes after he's been incarcerated, they tell him that they know that there's been a three-dimensional world around them the whole time, but they didn't want to tell the inhabitants of Flatland because it could cause social chaos, and that they've known about this other dimension the whole time. So that was just a satirical presentation of 140 years ago, but I think that's actually what's going on. I think we're surrounded by other dimensions of reality that are perfectly described by fractal geometry, but our whole Western education has wanted us to make it fit into linear sorts of ordinary shapes. Even you and me, we've been trained to fit into these ordinary shapes. And just looking at electromagnetism, we know it has fractal characteristics. And that's what Benoit Mandelbrot found from analysis of line noise at IBM, is that you have these fractal patterns. It's not just in space, it's in time, that a year looks like a month, looks like a week, looks like a second. It does in terms of your heart rate pattern. Just looking at the human body, I saw there were all these patterns in there that didn't fit the linear idea. That, in other words, a real big thing, idea that opened me to all these phenomena that I write about now was that the heart, a healthy heart, has a lot of variation in it. It's not linear. If it was linear, it wouldn't respond fast enough to external changes in our environment, right?
Yeah. And it would have inherent weak points as well.
It would have weak points. But all of these systems in nature are super resilient because that's what you get from millions of years of evolution, and it turned them fractal. And that means that they're very strong, though they're not always predictable, but they really react to variation. And so if that's true of our lungs and our hearts and our brainwaves, they have these fractal characteristics because we're all geared to adapt to an ever-changing environment where there could be lions and tigers and bears out there. But in the modern era, we've gotten used to lots of linear consistency, even temperatures, buildings that are squarish, and we forgot our fractal roots. But Mandelbrot pointed out that lots of these systems, even electrical and magnetic, have these fractal moments about them, which is what makes them work. And people have used that to create fractal compression algorithms and satellites and so forth. Mm. So what that means is that there's energy and life between dimensions, which you won't easily detect, but it's there. And you will, just like you said in the intro, you'll see it in the phenomena around us, even though it defies ordinary explanation. But if you know anything about fractals and chaos theory, you know that you should be looking for phenomena that don't fit ordinary definition of reality. It's just a little more complex. And so that's what opened me up to these phenomena. Even before I discovered remote viewing in 1996, I thought there have to be things that are real, just like Gödel's incompleteness theorem, right? And Alan Turing's idea, the Turing-Gödel idea that any logical system is inherently incomplete. There always are going to be things that are real that you don't know about from your logical system. You put those ideas together with fractals and you realize there should be something real. And when I came across remote viewing, I said, this is it. This is what I'm expecting to happen.
Well, and it's really interesting that you bring up remote viewing. I've here in the last year become a lifetime member of IRVA, the International Remote Viewing Association. I went out and, did many live interviews at their conference this last year for their anniversary.
Right. You were there. Great.
Yeah,
I was there remotely. That was so much fun listening to those.
It was incredible, you know, and hearing people like Hal Puthoff, especially, really one of the progenitor of this concept and the idea that, that strange science of interloping frequencies. And the idea that you can influence something at a distance because, well, your electron shells are no different. Like you and I are sharing an electron shell right now by all physics.
Right.
So the fact of those particles being able to intertwine, entangle, be able to be, I mean, they've got to know of each other's presence. Otherwise, they'd run into each other.
Right. And a lot of scientists have pointed out over the years, more of them from Russia than from here, but I think Nikola Tesla would have agreed, is that there can be fields of information just from electrons have the exclusion principle means they can't share all the same orbitals, which means when any of them move around, the whole chain of electrons in the system are going to experience it. That's a type of non-locality right there.
Yeah.
Without even the idea of entanglement. It's just that there's these repulsion exclusion principles that mean that the whole system responds to anything happening anywhere in the network. And we have all that already in dark matter, relic neutrinos, and these kind of fields that we're told exist from the cosmic background radiation, which I don't know if this is what explains it, but it certainly is a good idea as anything else, is that you already have fields of particles out there throughout the universe.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. There you go. And I just popped up on screen right now. This is last year's Nobel Prize in Physics was the fact of non-local reality and being able to quantum entangle particles at a distance. And it being proven. This is a concept that once again is nothing new. It's been around for a very long time and been in the world of quantum and theoretical physics, things like that, to have it actively proven, and not only proven, but double-blinded, reproven, and to the point of here's the biggest prize around for it. It's incredible, and it really does and should open up a whole new world to us scientifically and esoterically, period.
No, it's true, Chris. And that's the big mystery. Why aren't we reacting to what quantum mechanics tells us is real about the nature of non-locality? And I'm not sure if it's – I mean – there is debate, and this happens to be my latest YouTube video, which I put up. Is it quantum entanglement? Is it more a neutrino flux that explains these non-local interactions? There's always debate about that. But quantum mechanics did happen 120 years ago or so. And we're still acting as if it's a Newtonian world with these direct linear causation patterns like Newton.
Yeah.
Imagine that everything has a local cause. And we know now that from the work of many physicists, from Einstein, from his time around that time up until now, that there's all sorts of other influences going on that matter. And they don't just matter at the microscopic level. There's mesoscopic effects too of coherency. What is that? Bose-Einstein condensate. Discovered right here in Boulder, predicted by Einstein and Bose in 1925, but discovered in 1995, I mean, seen for the first time,
yeah,
which is a quantum coherent sort of fluid of particles, sure, at absolute zero, but it's still where the particles all overlap and become a big wave. It's just one particle, one big particle. That's yeah. a sort of mesoscopic, macroscopic effect. And so that's the real thing about it, Chris. If we know that quantum mechanics tells us that these sorts of objects exist in our reality where particles can become coherent and have all the same frequency and become just sort of one big wave pattern, why shouldn't we be surprised that there are all these phenomena around us that seem strange and weird that we call paranormal? But in fact, are the same analogy as a Bose-Einstein condensate to ordinary matter as ordinary phenomena are to paranormal phenomena. It's the same thing. Remote viewing, ghosts, haunted sites, strange effects around UFOs, even around Bigfoot, where people's, as I discovered studying that topic, where people's watches stop. If this was just an escaped gorilla or a relic primate, admittedly rare, like people believed, why would people's watches – have you ever gone to the zoo and your watch stopped while you're by the gorilla cages? That's never happened.
Yeah. And
so this is not an ordinary phenomenon. I believe the phenomena, just like you're saying, the witnesses tell us their battery stopped, their camera stopped around UFOs, even around remote viewing. This happened around Uri Geller.
Yep.
When Nick Halputoff and Russell were testing them, Russell Target, SRI, and Lawrence Livermore Labs, they had UFOs in the lab. They had cryptids. Remember this? It's the hitchhiker effect. It didn't start with Skinwalker Ranch.
Yeah.
It goes back to Uri Geller in the 70s, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because we have numerous times, and I'm very glad to have you on because I've been wanting to get into the topic of Bigfoot and the paranormal, Bigfoot and portals, all kinds of things. Because, yes, these stories have increased over the last many years. It's not like if you go back and look at first person Bigfoot accounts from the 60s, 70s, things like that, that you had an overwhelming number of them like this. There may have been a few, but it's really interesting to see that coming about. And even if you're talking, typical cryptozoology and the search for Sasquatch, what have you. One of the concepts that we've brought up is it the fact that this is actually the creature that we know as Sasquatch, or is it possibly something else that is using basically the tropes that we are comfortable with to expose themselves to us?
That's an interesting idea.
When it comes to because it not that and I am not excluding the fact that Bigfoot can't be there with portals, that portals don't exist. It's the problem of when it comes to research, which side of that quandary do you start from? Do you start from let's find the Sasquatch, then figure out how it makes a portal or how it finds a portal? Or do we find the portal and then figure out how a Sasquatch uses it, knows about it, and what about the Sasquatch? And I guess that's part of the problem when you come with the, when you, when you see the dual phenomena like that happening.
It's true. Yeah. No. There's a lot of questions that you're raising, yeah. which anyone who looks into this topic has to consider, because, and what's the evidence? Well, even groups of friends out hiking, once they've seen a Sasquatch, they can't agree sometimes with what they saw.
Yeah.
Some people said, no, it looked like a cat. And other people say, no, it looked like a gorilla. And then the other person says, no, no, I'm absolutely sure it looked like a caveman.
Yeah.
It looked like a cave. So what is going on there? Is it, I mean, endless question. Is it affecting our perception? Is it something that's presenting itself a certain way? But we do have hair samples. We do have footprints.
We do. We have oil samples. We have
rocks thrown at your car.
All kinds of things.
Dents.
And that's what I'm saying. I'm willing to consider the two as independent phenomena. That perhaps it's the fact that what is being reported with the portals and other paranormal phenomena is not necessarily Sasquatch as we know it.
Well,
and traditionally, like as far as native cultures discuss it across the globe.
Native cultures describe it as some sort of supernatural human, because if you listen to Dave Pilates' work on Bigfoot, and, you know, he has two books on Bigfoot.
Yeah.
They're both very interesting, Tribal Bigfoot, the Hoopa Project. You know, and these are very evidence-based descriptions. But even in these, you have strange things happening. I think, as he says in his recent videos that he has on YouTube, it pushed him very early in this investigation, which was funded by some wealthy entrepreneurs from Silicon Valley. It pushed him away from the idea that there was any ordinary explanation for what was going on. And the natives that he talked to, the Native Americans, and same things with First Nations people in Canada, they would all say it's something supernatural about it. And even our own accounts from newspapers, people describe something supernatural. But that to me is just it means that it's just science that we don't really understand yet. I mean, that's my bent as someone from the sciences, is that this is physics that we don't understand very well, but it's still happening. I have friends out here in the Boulder area who've hiked the Front Range all the way down to Arizona. And these people tell me of extremely strange things that have happened to them. Mm. And that's why I wrote Dark Matter Monsters, as the evidence kept building up. And you're right, Chris. There's more evidence for this now. More people are coming forward.
Oh, yeah.
It's typical of, and you've taken sociology classes. There's a name for this. We call it hidden events.
Yeah.
This is what you would expect to happen for hidden events, things that people have experienced, but they haven't shared publicly for whatever reason, stigma, ridicule.
Yeah.
Right.
No different than it doesn't, and I'll akin this to straight up real world folks, and I'll get as real as you can get. No different than the increase in the number of reports of pedophilia in the Catholic Church.
No,
it's not that it's happening more or that the numbers are different. It's the fact of more people are comfortable with coming forward. And when more people are comfortable with coming forward, you're going to find out a whole lot more.
You will. And this is the example that sociologist Ron Westrum used at several meetings that I attended of the International Society for the ISSS, International Society for the Study of – it'll come back to me. what the acronym is. At those meetings IRVA had some joint meetings with them too. Society for Scientific Exploration. Excuse me. That's another one that's part of SSE. Okay. He compared this to child abuse. This is exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
He had looked into this as a sociologist of what did it take for the United States to recognize that child abuse was real? Because before the 1960s, it wasn't considered a real diagnosis, just like these phenomena.
We're dealing with it right now. Like, hey, how about Epstein? Human trafficking. Yeah. That's a huge thing that we talk about on this show regularly.
Doctors,
People do not want to admit that that is in your backyard, no, Jack.
It's going on. It's the same sort of thing in the sense that people won't talk about it. Yeah. And doctors did not want to accuse parents of abusing their kids.
Yeah.
So the counter explanations, kind of like we've heard for UFOs, like it's a, you know, it's a weather balloon, it's swamp gas, it's misidentifications of Venus. These were used for child abuse, too. They would say, oh, the child had thin bones. The child fell from a tree.
Yeah.
Or they were, you know, attacked by bullies at school, which does happen. But that wasn't the whole explanation for the whole phenomena. And, and you see the same sort of intellectual alibis being used for UFOs, Bigfoot encounters, where the law enforcement will tell people you saw a bear. They've been instructed to say you saw a bear no matter what you saw. Right? Bears that were bipedal that threw rocks at you. I never encountered a bear that does that. And yet that's what witnesses are told. They're told this over and over again until they're numb. You pretty saw sure a bear. You need and maybe they'll believe it. Like
pretty sure you need an opposable digit for throwing a rock.
You do. Last time I checked, bears do not
paws don't work for throwing rocks.
They cannot pick up your car. Bears do not do this sort of thing. They're very good at climbing. They don't throw things. They don't lift things up. And so this is, it's a very good parallel, Chris. And this is what would sociologists would say is we're not saying that child abuse and UFOs, it's not the same thing, but it has the same reaction from society. Until you have meetings like our society is going through this right now with UFOs.
Yep.
It took federal attention and meetings in D.C. and Chicago, as Westrom pointed out, before the professionals actually said this is real, Pete. This child abuse is real. It took about till 1965 and a couple really confident individuals who brought law enforcement and doctors together, psychiatrists, and they agreed, you know, child care workers. It took a consensus to around data. And so this is what's going on with UFOs and UAP. And I imagine it will happen with cryptids eventually, too.
Yep.
Is we went too far to the extreme to push these topics away because we didn't want to deal with it. And I think what it shows us, which should cause alarm to all of us, is that the professionals pushed it away.
Yeah.
The professional scientists really didn't do their job here because they kept saying it was a weather balloon, it's ice crystals, and they're happy to keep their positions at these universities while ridiculing the witnesses, which I think is not acceptable.
That is one of the things that we discuss regularly on the show, Dr. Simeon, is the fact of the deviation, the scientific deviation, and why is the scientific deviation not being, because the deviation is what needs to be studied. And it's the fact sure. Hey, I am willing to, because I am a full on believer's believer, Doc. However, I am a skeptic with a scientific mind. And the thing is, folks, a skeptic isn't there to like shoot down everything you believe in. We're there to look at a logical thing and we're there to have our own minds and belief changed. Where any good skeptic is willing to say, wow, I was totally wrong about that. Interesting. And I'm a believer's believer, but at the same time, I know that that requires incredible evidence.
It requires persistence.
Yeah. It requires not clogging my own filter.
Chris, what it requires is the ability to want to look at evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not just the evidence, it's this actual desire to look at evidence. And it's very easy once you get a degree like I have, a PhD, to become kind of a snob and to turn your nose down at what people say they perceive. Because you have this ivory tower where you can always retire to and you can lock your door to your office.
You can just go write a paper and people will listen.
Write a paper and I feel disappointed in the academic system for not getting onto this topic sooner. I mean, why did they wait for the New York Times article in 2017? They're supposed to come before the news articles, but they didn't. They just jumped on the bandwagon, changed the name to UAP, and now it's a hot topic.
Once again, I mean, even right there, your book show, a book opening minds about crop circles. That's one of the main things that I bring up all the time. Whenever you're talking paranormal, cryptids, crop circles, UFO, UAP, doesn't matter. There is that 2 to 3% deviation where it's
exactly.
Wow,
There is the 2 to 3% that are outside the norm. No one wants to look at that 2 to 3%.
And that's the problem. That's not science.
And it's
not. That's like, imagine if we allowed a 2% deviation in architecture.
Yeah, exactly. That is good.
You know, if we allowed a 2% deviation of accuracy in architecture, if you had 100% a solution that you were waiting to come out and only 93% came out, and you went, well, okay.
No, Chris, this is, you know, the author Nassim Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan and other books like that.
Yes,
Black
I'm familiar. Swan
and other books about kind of misconceptions in probability, and he comes out of the financial world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his books are all really good. So he points out in these books that the Romans used to make engineers sleep under the bridges they built.
Yeah.
And the British changed that in medieval times, the early British Empire. In Britain, they made the engineers and their families sleep under the bridges.
Yeah.
So this is called Skin in the Game, which is another one of his books. So now, this is what we're missing from the whole system is skin in the game.
Yeah, precisely.
We're missing this. You can just be a BS artist and get away from it, get away with it. Oh, for like a century of BS until all of a sudden UAP are real. And someone has pointed this out recently that everyone has come out of these classified hearings. There are classified hearings going on right now in Washington, D.C. about UAP, what we used to call UFOs, which was fine with me because they look like objects to me. But people coming out of those briefings are senators and congresspeople. Chris, they look very somber. They don't look excited. So they're hearing something that is really distressing to them, and they're not telling us. I don't know what it is and what we're going to find out. It's probably a lot more than that. We can't control our airspace. Okay. It's probably a bigger picture of the entire evolution of us, our planet and our species that we weren't told about. And they're hearing the full thing. I mean, they said, who's ever briefing them is saying, look, you guys wanted the briefing. Okay. Here it is.
Here it is. Yeah.
We're hybrids. There's other alien species around that are abducting people nightly. We can't do anything about it. There's a hybridization program going on. In fact, humans aren't even a completely natural species. It's something like that. And then they're talking about cryptids somewhere in the briefing too, that who are these other animal creature life forms are that we never were told about in our high school biology class. And that's probably a pretty heavy thing. And this is what you get when you don't have public discussion for a century, is they're just going to lay it all on you in a couple hours. What should have come over 100 years came in a couple hours. And that's why they're looking somber.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, not a lot of people see things in the windfall aspect like that. And unfortunately, that's the case, that most people do not see it either in that way or in the fractal way that things touch each other and affect each other. Which once again, I'll just bring our conversation right back to that topic and the concept of fractal and how one thing affects the other. And even when you're talking about electrons having to move around each other so that they don't collide, that means, like you said, that brings about the whole concept of chaos theory and how the movement of one thing affects something all the way on the other side.
No, it's true. I remember the early news reports of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
In February, was it 2021? Yeah, right at the early time.
Yeah.
And the president at the time, I mean, the reports were only 60 people have it in the U.S. We've got this under control. Do you remember that
briefing? Yeah.
Oh, We've got this under control. 60 people. We know who they are. They've been quarantined. We've got this.
I'm a traveling AV technician. I saw it go from full seating at a show one week, traveled across the country for another client. It was like, wow. Only a third of the people showed up.
Yeah, right.
Interesting. How come nobody from Asia showed up?
Right.
And then a week later, we were getting ready for South by Southwest here in Austin, and it was like, well, I guess the whole world just shut down.
Yeah, that's when outliers go mainstream and there aren't outliers anymore. But you're taught to throw out the outliers. This is what I learn in statistics is you throw out the outliers that don't fit the regression line. Why? Well, you want to publish, and the stronger your statistical results are, the more impact your paper makes, the more column inches you get for your paper. And you throw out – the more outliers throw out, the more your regression line looks stronger. So it's like –
well,
great.
No. And I can see statistically why and scientifically and funding-wise why you would want to do that. Because if you ain't got the numbers and, hey, if you're gonna get into 3% with people, like that's going to make some people real curious why you can't answer for the 3% when you're asking me for some money. Right. Where's that other 3% going and why aren't we making money on it?
Well, you remember the Who's album Quadrophrenia?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is quantophrenia.
Yeah.
It's like an illness where you have to – it's only the numbers and you keep twiddling with the numbers. You keep doctoring them until it shows what you want because that's where your funding comes from. Do you see where the problem is here?
Yeah.
Is once it's all oriented towards funding and publication, people are going to game the system. And what happens after decades of gaming the system is you don't have any idea what reality is anymore. And that's where we are. Chris, this is where we are right now in this country. It's been gamed for so long by bureaucrats and people that know how to manipulate the system for their own funding needs and their own paychecks, the consistency they want, people that work in sciences and so forth. I'm not blaming them. I'm just saying the system had a bias in it towards towing the line. I'm right down the street from CU where Edward Condon created the Condon Report for the Air Force, which the Air Force wanted to shut down. They gave him $500,000, a lot of money in 1970, to justify shutting down Project Blue Book.
Yep.
And he admitted that he already had the conclusion before looking at any of the cases.
Yeah, he had zero interest in scientific study.
Right.
That's
just gaming the system to do what they want you to do. And he wanted his security clearance. By the way, this is a very interesting little historical footnote. Edward Condon had lost his security clearance because of his involvement with quantum mechanics. It was considered to be like
pseudoscience.
Pseudoscience or Soviet tinged science.
Because it was like Soviet quackery.
Yeah, it was different. And so you could get your. Even in the 50s, he discovered quantum tunneling. I believe he won a Nobel. Did he win a Nobel Prize for quantum tunneling?
I believe so.
He did. He was a well-known freaking physicist. We all accept quantum tunneling. It's what makes your electronics and my electronics work. Without quantum tunneling, you don't even have the sun. Okay. According to what science tells us. But back in the 50s, it was considered so controversial. Just like Einstein's relativity theory, where there's a natural suspicion, but we have of new ideas. Which it's not inherently wrong, but in this case, it led to him losing his security clearance. And he wanted that back so badly, he probably kowtowed to the Air Force, which put us in the situation now we're in where we're shooting down balloons. We've overreacted. So even a party balloon coming over Lake Huron or whatever that was, the experimental balloon that those experimentalists said it was.
Yeah.
It's a bizarre situation where we don't know what's going on and we're not looking at what's really in the skies and we're calling them phenomena, which is almost a step backward. It leads to a general confusion. We have to demand transparency and honesty with this, even if good old Einstein.
Yeah.
He would have loved this conversation. I mean, he was a realist. He wasn't even completely happy with quantum mechanics as it's currently formulated.
No. And I mean, even one of my greatest points in life ever was stepping into the apartment in Bern, Switzerland, where he wrote the equation and seeing a copy of it up on the wall and seeing this tiny little apartment that he lived in. It was just like, wow, man, to wake up with something like that in your mind. Incredible.
There's questions if Einstein knew about the UFO phenomena. Was he did turn down once. I think they asked him to be on one of these defense boards in the Pentagon and he wouldn't do it. But the main point is that we don't want science to be completely top-down controlled the way it became, where you're told if you don't toe the party line, you're out. You won't get tenure. You won't get promoted. And you won't, you know, you got your eyes on the prize, and it compromises our scientific integrity.
Yeah.
This isn't new. I just want to point out one thing. A couple hundred years ago, exactly around 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s, meteorites were not considered to be real either. And they threw them away from the museums in France because the French Academy of Sciences considered it to be folklore, peasant folklore. They just thought they had to be terrestrial. Why? The mindset they had at the time is there were no rocks in the sky. They just couldn't imagine where these – so it was impossible. There cannot be stones in the sky, as the French saying went, because there are no stones in the sky. There are stones in the sky. They come from an extraterrestrial source. And it took Chladni and Biot, two scientists at the time, Chladni being actually the father of acoustics. He created the wave function before Schrodinger for one, you know, simple wave function. And he looked at – there was one event in 1804 which changed everyone's mind. It was a huge meteorite fall in Eagle, France. In one night, thousands of small rock pieces fell down in an elliptical pattern. You can find this book on Amazon called The Meteor Report, written by – I think it was written by Biot, Jean-Baptiste Biot. And he basically – they said an elliptical pattern means it had to come from the sky. If it was volcanoes and things, they would be randomly distributed all over France. And that turned out to be true. That the reason it looked elliptical is it was coming down at an angle. And that one event changed everything. So, Chris, this is going to happen with the UFO phenomenon. All these topics we're talking about.
And
you did one big set of evidence.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the dominoes fall down.
Yeah, it's once again the sad fact of if you wanted to write a paper or do some research on something that's a 85 to 90 percentile, I guarantee you, you could probably get funding or a grant pretty darn quick. If you're trying to research something that's within the 10 percentile or less of possibility or probability, good luck.
That's exactly what happened.
Good luck getting the money or convincing somebody that it's even worthwhile looking for or looking into.
Chris, this is a serious issue. I know people from biochemistry who've quit academia over this. They were really good at getting funding for their department. And the day they thought about quitting was when the provost came in from the university, whatever provosts do, or one of those administrators, and said, you have made so much money for us. Because, you know, universities, there's like a cut that the university gets for every grant. I forget the name. Well, you know, what's the name for it again? It's like
I can't remember.
Overhead. They get this percentage, and it can be quite large. It could be 30 or 40% of the grant just goes right to the university. It's not just 5%, what a business would expect. It's a pretty large chunk that the university can negotiate. And this person came in one day and said, you have made so much money for us. And this, my friend thought, is that what this is all coming down to? You know, is this why I got a PhD, just to make money for a university? Like, being used like a.
Yes, you got your PhD so you could go work in a lab for somebody else and get $100 a patent and they could make billions.
That's exactly what it is. She told me. I've talked to other people like this. They worked in biochem and then they were told, well, your only option is to work for big pharma.
Yeah.
And when they started working on these projects, they didn't like what they were hearing, which was hide the data that doesn't support the efficacy of our pharmaceutical. We know all about this, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So if this attitude infects the whole system, it's only people like us and people that you and I know that are doggedly pursuing the data stream to say, yes, it's in the 10%, but 10% can make a big difference when it's the structural integrity of an aircraft. Do you want to fly in an aircraft where there's 10% variation in the ability of the landing gear?
You know, let me give you $10 and take one away.
Yeah.
Well, and we just had a conversation with Ryan Edwards, a cryptozoologist out of the San Antonio area. And it's the idea of, do you want to share with only 95% of one of the legs?
Yeah. 5% of the time it's going to collapse.
Yeah. 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 You know, where it's all good. Kind of like, living in a two-party system, that kind of sounds like a lean-to, not a house.
Right. No.
There's only two walls there. Wait a minute.
We wouldn't accept that in aircraft or buildings.
And no other, like I said, good luck with finding a 2% deviation in architecture. They will not allow it. You can't caulk that. You can't caulk a 2% crack in something.
And so to be honest, when we encounter this with what we call paranormal phenomena, we should say, what is going on here? Chris, when I started studying crop circles, I would say maybe 5% of them affected our cameras and batteries.
Yeah.
To the point where the device wouldn't work. It would literally go on the fritz right there in the crop circle.
Wow.
That's what Opening Minds was about, is discovering all these weird magnetic and electrical effects. I used to build electrical kits when I was a kid. I mean, I would save up my money and go to Heathkit or Radio Shack and assemble kits. I knew that when you walk in a crop circle, an insulator like wheat is not supposed to burn out your camcorder. No way.
Yeah.
No way. It would have happened while I was building my radios and kits as a kid, and it never happened. But here I'm walking into these symmetrical patterns. And some of the time, it was enough for me. You would see your camera or someone else's camera just stop working instantly. And so that showed me there has to be something else going on here, more than even static charge, because I would ask farmers. I said, have you ever had your tractor or your camera stop working while you were out here harvesting the wheat? They'd all say never. It's only in that particular shape. So that should tell you there's something about the shape itself.
Now, when you were this is just curiosity, because I would love to have you on sometime to talk specifically about crop circle.
Yeah, sure.
That is honestly one of the topics that got me. I think I was, like, it was sophomore year in high school. I did a report for my English class on crop circles. And I mean, man, I had overhead slides. I had all kinds of stuff, overlays. It was intense. But when you're talking about that, and especially the energies that come from that, what kind of differences were there with adjoining fields, with even parts of the same property?
No, right. That's right. That's the question. Was it sort of like an entire set where it had something to do with the standing crop and the portion of the crop that was downed?
Yeah.
And some sort of polarity between standing crop, which is not touching the other stalks, versus the stalks that are pushed down, and now they're all like in like a liquid crystalline shape, you know, having the same sort of properties like liquid crystals. And so you look at it like an entire system. It's a big question. Is it the field, literally the field of wheat that you're in? Is it something about underground springs? Is it? We looked at a lot of this, and the conclusion I came to, which I'm happy to talk about in great detail another time, is it's something about the pattern itself, which we realized when we started paying farmers to make our own circles to see if we could even get close to what we were seeing out there in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And we would find that our own circles would cause massive distortions in cameras and batteries and so forth, which suggested that there was something very interesting about the shape that was organizing the energy.
So even the circles that y'all created.
Yeah.
Wow.
Some of them would create the same effects we saw in the other ones. Now, we didn't believe that.
Same exterior effects, not same effects to the crop itself, where there were like extended nodes.
No, we got those too. We got those too. Didn't believe it. This is real field research, Chris. We were literally out there thinking these could only be made by ball lightning or UFOs or something. But we just think, well, we should make a few as a control, and we would get the exploded nodes and all the stuff in our own formations.
I mean, granted, as an audio engineer, a lot of that makes sense, especially when you start talking cymatics, things like that, the science of vibration, cymatics, frequency.
Exactly.
The idea of being even if the fact of that area was harmonizing with a frequency that it was just on a ley line with.
Exactly right. This is sort of where my mind did not want to go there initially. I had believed the same things that we had all been told at these conferences, but it didn't turn out to be true.
Well, even at that point, though, like, where was cymatics Nobody was really, you didn't see a whole lot of videos out there. There weren't people playing around with it in their garage and making oobleck and things like that.
Cymatics, you know? That exactly what we were talking about. Ernst Chladni, the German physicist that created acoustics and physics, he's considered the father of cymatics. And that's where you end up with, is there something about the shape that's generating frequencies or vice versa, that frequencies could create shapes?
Yeah. Yeah,
precisely. There's a relationship there, and I think Chladni would have understood it, but it's definitely extremely strange, whatever it is, because you just normally do not have your cameras and batteries draining just like that. I mean, literally the solder melting inside the cameras when they're put down on the crop, literally melting.
Wow.
I've seen it with my own eyes over and over again, and you never really heard this in the media reports. They just wanted to focus, is it man-made or real?
Yeah.
And this is why I always said that's not the main question. There's something else beyond man-made or real that's important here from a physics point of view. But, Chris, the real mind blower for me was once I started talking to Bigfoot witnesses in the Front Range here in Colorado, the same camera and battery effects, they were reporting the same thing that we had seen in crop circles around Bigfoot. That's what really got me thinking along these directions. This is why I call the book Dark Matter Monsters.
Yeah.
Is I realized there has to be something. You're just not going to have cameras and batteries.
No.
It has to be the same fundamental principle. You get ball lightning around crop circles. You get ball lightning around cryptids.
Yeah.
You get ball lightning around UFOs. You get people's cameras and batteries failing around UFOs. So there must be some underlying pattern from UFOs to crop circles to cryptids. And
even paranormal. I mean, I used to work with a paranormal investigation group in Houston years ago and had that happen numerous times.
Oh, you've seen it yourself.
We're quite literally like size C batteries for the tape recorder, like brand new, just went out and bought them.
You've seen that yourself at haunted locations.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've seen charged batteries that like, okay, we took them off the charger when we left the house and 2 hours later, dead. Nothing in them.
This is exactly what we saw around the crop circles multiple times. People would say, I just bought those batteries and they're flat as a pancake.
Yeah.
And they're also really hot right now. It's like they just expended all their charge.
Yep.
You get this around ball lightning. People will say that they get even Nikola Tesla blew out a few transformers in Manhattan and Colorado Springs.
He blew out a lot of things in Colorado Springs.
So you start thinking along
so
those
lines. So much
so
they almost kicked him out.
They almost kicked him out. And this is how you end back. So the Soviet researchers into ball lightning and these sorts of phenomena concluded it was the fractal organization of dark matter that's actually causing all these effects. And this is how I ended up in that direction, is just looking at decades of Soviet research into micro ball lightning. What they called electromagnetic phantoms.
Okay.
Electromagnetic phantoms. They concluded that fractal geometry was the basis of this that goes all the way down to the zero point field. There's a continuity all the way to the zero point field from the Koch snowflake shape, which, by the way, was the first crop circle shape I ever saw when I landed there. Yeah. So there are certain fractal shapes that allow energy to flow and compress matter in ways that ordinary, like we were talking about, ordinary linear shapes don't do this. It's fractal shapes because they're self-similar from the micro to the macro scale that are actually the basis of ball lightning, the basis of compression of matter, black holes, and dark matter. At least that's the direction I've gone in since looking at this.
Yeah.
Exactly. See that shape that you see that shape on the right of the page? Soviet mathematicians, researchers and mathematicians who are no longer alive, published an entire paper on this, which they published saying the Koch snowflake is the only shape in nature that completely connects to zero point energy. That's the only shape that will do it. And when they built coils in those shapes, they could remove the equipment and they would have what they called an electromagnetic phantom floating over the desk where the equipment had been shut off and removed.
Because
it makes sense, right? Just from an engineering standpoint.
Yeah, so if you look at that just as just somebody who builds his own antennas, things like that, that is literally the basis of a fractal antenna.
Right. Like, and that's right the basis there. Of ball lightning.
Wow.
It's the basis of orbs and ball lightning. And if you follow the logic of that, it led me to the idea that there are life forms based on these fractal shapes, which we call cryptids, that somewhere in their physiology, their physical structure or their vibration or frequency is compressing matter in the same way that these Soviet scientists realized you could create loops and coils.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Closed pointing vectors of fractal Maxwellian shapes that instead of pointing outward and creating an external electromagnetic field, pointed back in all the way down to the zero point field.
Yeah. And I mean,
it's big stuff.
It's huge stuff. It's huge stuff. And I mean, I'm holding in my hand right here, folks, something called an EBO. I'm a musician.
Oh, the EBO. Yeah.
EBOs kind of work in the same concept. It's basically an electromagnet that when you get it near it picks up the field of the guitar pickup and goes in the opposite direction.
Wow.
And actively causes the string to vibrate in between the two of them.
Oh,
as though you are bowing it with a string. So, wow.
I always saw the ads for that in those guitar magazines.
That's how an EBO works.
Oh, that's how
it is. And it sounds like you're bowing a guitar string.
It sounds like the EBO, which Ken Shoulders, the exotic vacuum object, what he calls ball lightning, charge clusters.
Yeah. And it's interesting because one of the things that I loved hearing, we've had Kathleen Martin from MUFON and one of the founders of the MUFON Experiencer resource team on numerous times. She is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill.
Right. I've talked to her there. Yeah.
Amazing, amazing individual. And she shared a story about an experiencer. She was saying how many of these experiences now and contactee experiences have gone into the realm of supernatural and gone into the realm of paranormal. And her research in and of itself has gone that way and gone out of field hard research into research into the phenomenology of this because of the story of the individual who, while experiencing a craft, went to touch it and passed through the craft. Now, interestingly enough, when I attended the IRVA conference, the remote viewing conference this last year, Hal Puthoff talked about the exact same case.
Oh, really?
He's read onto a lot of panels when it comes to that stuff. And I am firmly convinced that once you're at certain levels like that, they just read you on as a just in case. Because it may come the fact that this ties into the research that we paid you for a long time ago. And the scary thing is you could talk about this new stuff and not the old stuff. So, but if we read it on to you, you can't talk about any of it.
Yeah, right. You can't talk about the old stuff. It's really strange. You don't go back to Roswell or Phoenix Lights or Hudson Valley.
You can't talk about all that because you were read on to the conversation.
Yeah, that's what he told me too when I talked with him. He said that's the problem in the American system, and it's the same thing.
Well, and it's a problem with submitting into that system of being read on to and being on a government panel about something.
Be honest. That's right. Exactly how put off. Gave us this lecture at SSE IRVA in Vegas in 2018. And this is exactly – this is a couple of years before you saw him. So this is what he told us. And I talked to him personally about this.
Yeah, same, at breakfast.
And he said it's brought the Soviet Union down, this compartmentalization where you can't talk to anyone outside your special access program.
Yeah.
He said – he told me this is what brought the Soviet Union down. They were ahead of the U.S. in electronics. Microelectronics in the 50s, right? Which is why they had Sputnik.
Massively.
Massively ahead of us in terms of vacuum tubes and transistors and all of this stuff. They had independently invented a lot of this.
If I have my choice between any Russia-made circuit or an American equivalent, sorry, I'll buy Russian all day long.
Yes.
Their parts are better quality. Their build quality is like, it's literally works of art. On the inside, when you open up guitar pedals and stuff, like everything is military grade parts. It was all military factories.
It's all, but What brought it down, Chris, what
was the same thing.
Yeah, what brought it down was the secrecy and the paranoia and the suspicion. Yeah. It wasn't the technology. I've worked with, before the Soviet Union fell apart, I actually worked with Soviet scientists at a research institute one summer in Vienna, south of Vienna, EASA. And it was in that program as a grad student, and I worked with a lot of these folks before their society sort of came apart. It wasn't their lack of ability to create this technology, or their scientists who understood fractals and all this. They understood everything we're talking about here. It was the lack of communication between different organizations. And Hal told us the same thing could happen to the U.S. And you know what he called it? A Sputnik moment.
Oh, wow. Wow.
He said we could have a Sputnik moment because some society, maybe Jamaica, could go ahead of us just because they have better communication. Between scientists and the compartmentalization. We know this is true, but we haven't done enough about it. It prevents scientific progress.
Well, hearing him speak, and especially about the same case, and especially about the phenomena of mutual experience, the way that we were talking a minute ago, where everybody's reality is different. You ask two kids that were brought up in the same house, and guaranteed they have slightly different recollections of the exact same events, depending on the emotional filter which they see the world. You know. However, the idea of somebody being in a location and being able to see either a Sasquatch or that object in the sky and the person next to them not being able to. The phenomenology of that being explained by Hal as literally vibration. Somebody being in the correct vibratory state. And the example he brought up was the case that Kathleen Martin was talking about where the person passed through. And he was I love the fact that he brought it up like it was the Flash comics. he was vibrating the same way the Flash does to pass through a wall.
That is matching. This is very interesting. This is very interesting because what this more recently Russian scientists looking at this have come up with is that some objects are inherently blurry.
Mm.
Because their permittivity has variation in it, that it's flipping back and forth between not positive and negative permittivity. Permittivity being the fundamental electric constant of space and objects' ability to resist electrical charge.
Okay.
Kind of like the idea, the difference between, wood and metal. The difference in permittivity is, one material has a lower permittivity, metals, versus higher permittivity like insulators, like rubber, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason a lot of these paranormal objects look blurry, because people always complain, how come there's no really good photos of them like there was of the Chinese spy balloon? They look blurry because they are blurry. Can you understand that?
Well,
they don't have a constant permittivity. There is variation in the permittivity. And people that have studied ball lightning, Chris, Ken Shoulders, Hal Puthoff's colleague for a long time, also worked at SRI for NSA doing microelectronics, early versions of drones and so forth. Yeah. Mm. So Ken Shoulders has this whole article, if you look him up, about how ball lightning has its own permittivity, which means it's operating in a different frame of reference. It has a different speed of light. That's what Hal's lecture to us was about in Vegas, is if you change permittivity from these UFO materials, you're literally changing the speed of light. The speed of light is based on the permittivity and permeability, the magnetic constant. So if you make this as an engineer, you make any changes in permeability or permittivity, you no longer have objects that are in our frame of reference, which means they're going to look really strange and all the phenomena around them are going to be extremely strange. That's what Hal told us. It just took me a couple of years to put it all together, finding Ken Shoulders and realizing that Hal's idea about permittivity might have come from Ken Shoulders. I mean, even though Hal's an engineer, engineer physicist, but Ken Shoulders also talked about this. They worked together. Is that you can have objects in their own frame of reference that don't interact with us the same way, and they're going to look strange, and they're going to look blurry or blue shifted. So this is another component of what we call paranormal, is just, yes, but there you go. So there are all these strange phenomena around ball lightning, because it's not literally a biochemical object. It's not just chemically burning like a flame.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like it's a gas ball or something like that.
No, it's not a gas ball. It's a coherent matter object with its own frame of reference, its own permittivity. And any life form or object like a UFO hull that changes permittivity is literally going to have its own speed of light frame of reference.
Yeah.
It's going to seem faster. Yeah. It's going to seem fast compared to
others. Speed of light is only a constant in a vacuum, not through a medium. So once you start, the light will not penetrate the solid object, but let's not forget that is just a repulsion of electrons.
Right.
That is not a solid object.
That's right. And
so once you start vibrating those electrons and changing that, then yes, light could utterly pass or bend through it.
You end up with what Ron Moorhead called the quantum Bigfoot. And he would know, because you know Ron Moorhead. He was out there in the Sierras. He wrote the book Voices in the Wilderness. And he would say, we could never see them. Light passed through them. The closest you got was something like that Saran wrap effect, the predator effect.
Yeah, yeah.
He would record them right outside their hunting structures. You've heard of that Sasquatch, the Sasquatch sounds, the Sierra sounds.
Oh, yeah.
You hear them chattering back and forth, arguing, or whatever they're talking about. And you would not – the mics were embedded in the wall of their hunting structure high up in the Sierra Nevadas, like 10 miles up from the road. Well, you had to get there by horseback. But you would pop your head out there, and there was no shadows cast by them. And yet you hear them on the tapes. And they had skeptics with them. Al Berry, who was their skeptic, science educated guy. He came up as a skeptic and became convinced. He never saw them. There were the sounds on the recorder. They were there. The metal clanging sounds that you heard around the camp. People report this around Bigfoot. It was also in Stan Gordon's book, Silent Invasion, about the Pennsylvania Bigfoot UFO sightings in the 70s. So, Chris, when I put all this together, I realized we're dealing with life forms that are based on a different type of physics than we're used to, but it doesn't mean it's any less real than UFOs are real or ball lightning. Those are based on different types of physics too. And you know how we know this? Because of that book by James Lakatsky, Skinwalkers at the Pentagon. Are you familiar with that book?
Yes, I am. I have been trying to reach out to them for the longest time about that book.
Kellerer, Knapp, and Lakatsky.
Yeah.
Right. Do you read that book written by someone who's a missile signals analyst, Mazint, at DIA, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about all of this, saying you had these objects on the trails at Skinwalker Ranch that were like so dark. You know, they were darker than the night. That sounds like an object to me that's absorbing light, like what Ken Shoulders would call a black Evo. Didn't emit any light. It's like a black hole, a little mini black hole right there in front. You get these dogmen, werewolves, whatever you want to call those huge wolves that walk on two legs that look sort of like a man wolf hybrid.
Yeah.
They would see them out there. They would see other creatures that don't have names, right? People called them the dino beaver, a couple hundred pound beaver with a stegosaurus plates on its back and a huge tail. So you look at this, and then Lakatsky tells us he went to the other intelligence agencies and said, would you like to work with us to find out what's going on? Because these cryptids, he doesn't literally say this, but you know he's implying it. These cryptids are seen throughout the United States. Maybe we should be looking at this, right? And what do the other intel agencies say to him?
Nah.
We can't do it because it would make us look weird.
Yeah.
And we have to think about funding. So we're going to say no. We're not looking at cryptids. So here you have all these witnesses experiencing across the United States who have nowhere to go to talk about this. Law enforcement doesn't know about it. They think these people are delusional, or they know and they're just trying to avoid dealing with it because they don't have. So this is where you end up when you're just, again, thinking about only funding and not about what's experienced. So Lakatsky did the right thing, I think. The big thing he invents in this book is the idea of the hitchhiker effect, which is that these DIA researchers, if you ever talk to him, he'll tell you about this. They go home back to their Maryland suburbs, nice cozy suburbs in Maryland outside of DC. Yeah. And they see these dogmen out the windows in their homes, and their kids see them, and they haven't, this is a classified program. They haven't talked to their spouses and kids about what they saw at Skinwalker. They're seeing the same cryptids. It lends this idea that there's, you know, layers of reality once you start dealing with this. A friend of mine suggested maybe that they're interacting with dark matter, literally changes their frequency, and you start attracting these things, or whatever the explanation is. It's like tuning the channels on your TV to a paranormal channel you didn't know existed. But this is James freaking Lekatsky. This is not a paranormal investigator from conferences I've met who's funding this on their own dime. Yeah. They're funded by your tax dollars, and they're telling us it's real.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, the experiences at Skinwalker Ranch, especially from the Bigelow team, things like that, they had some really, really interesting stories. Let's just say that
stories.
And portals opening up, critters walking out, then walking back into them.
Chris, I met a researcher from Canada that worked with NIDS.
Oh, wow.
Saw it with his own eyes.
Wow.
This is long before I knew about Skinwalker Ranch, around 2000. Wow. I had heard about it from Chris O'Brien, who, as we learned in the book Hunt for the Skinwalker by Keller and Knapp, was one of like two civilians allowed on the ranch that Bigelow allowed on that wasn't part of his science team, right? Yeah. They didn't allow people, but they let Chris O'Brien, for some reason, and he talked about, I heard him talk about it in about 1998. Around here in San Luis Valley, he gave a little conference, and I heard about these things. Then about a couple of years later, in the crop circles, I'm out there walking around a crop circle, and this Canadian researcher tells me, I was part of the NIDS team, and he told me we had the cameras, infrared, pointed at this road, and this hole opened up in the road, and a very large bipedal creature walked out of the hole as if it was a portal.
Yeah.
And he said, we were shaking in our boots.
I'll because bet.
This thing was really big. We had no idea what it is. We're not that far away. And it just walks off into the darkness, and the portal closes up. And he said, we recorded it on camera. It's on film somewhere.
We haven't seen
a lot of that Bigelow material.
We'll never see it.
I don't know why. It's not a subject to FOIA, apparently, because it's a private contractor.
Yep. And that's exactly why it's in the world of private contracting and everything else, is because it's not subject to FOIA. That's right.
This is why they do this, apparently. Yeah. I was told this.
It's precisely why.
They contract it out. This is the government's way of avoiding the conversation. But Chris, why are we avoiding this conversation? You and I are touching on a lot. Once again,
to ignore a 2% deviation is dangerous. I don't know of any other industry where a 2% deviation is allowed or not investigated.
It led to the credit collapse of 2007-8. Do you remember this when all these banks had interlocking swap agreements?
Yeah.
And no one ever expected the house of cards to fall apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it was one of those, I forget which brokerage firm, Lehman Brothers or something, their credit swaps, their whole system, they had a collapse. And that means they couldn't honor their agreements with other banks, right? And the government had to step in overnight to prevent the entire system from coming down. So this is what you get with a 2% deviation that you don't want to look at
in the long run. How dangerous do you think it is? Scientifically, because I mean, of course, and I'm not going to get into C words. I'm not going to get into pandemics, because anything beyond that, and I guarantee you, the algorithms will find us. I've got a lot of muted content, my friend. But when you're talking about this kind of information and science and the idea of It's science, trust it. One of the things I talk about on this show regularly is, let's not forget, until the turn of the 1900s, like, if you were sick, it was bad air. There weren't germs. Doctors weren't concerned about washing their hands before they saw you.
That's right.
Or before they reached into their your body to try to fix something and just tinker around and see if they could do something. You know, right. Like this is not long ago, Dr. Simeon. It's not ago that all of humanity believed so hard that the world was flat that if you said it was round, we'd burn you at the stake.
Exactly right. Now, you need to read this book by David Wooden. He has a book, The Discovery of Science, but another one is called Bad Medicine. Mm. And what is it about? How the medical community ignored Louis and Hoke's microscope for 150 years and preferred to believe in the
ethers.
The ethers and the fluids, the humors.
Yeah, yeah. The humors. The
imbalance of basically.
Yeah. Well, you got bile inside of you right now. I mean, that's literally the source of why we call bile bile. It's the yellow stuff that came out. And if you had bile or
they believed in a theory which had no evidence to support it, just none. Because that's what they were taught. And you know why they said they wouldn't use a microscope? Because they said they had eyes from God and they didn't need to look.
I was just about to say it's the devil's work, more than likely.
They would use all
horribly.
Wooden said how many people could have been saved by using a microscope to see microbes that we knew existed, but doctors said we don't need it. We don't need a microscope. We already know what's going on. We're happy with Galen's idea of fluid imbalance from the Greeks. Going back to So this is a really good point. Is we can be held back by superstition when we don't want to look at data, and all this stuff we're talking about today seems to me. It's data. It's the 2% you don't want to look at. But in the there's a reason I called my book Black Swan Ghosts, the book on the far right. Mm-hmm. I called that for a reason, because these are black swan events. When the chair finally collapses from that 2% variation you didn't want to look at, or more seriously, when planes crash or we have accidents that we knew could be prevented because we didn't want to look at that variation in the algorithm or whatever it was in the autopilot that was flying the plane that you'll find that engineers knew about, but they were told, well, you know, that's so improbable, we're just going to ignore it. But then it happens, right?
Yeah.
This is what's going to happen with these topics if you continue to ignore it, is it builds up in people's experience. Even the phenomena itself could be organizing itself right now and we're not paying attention to it. It could be trying to tell us something, but we're ignoring it. And that's where – so you're sort of in a sort of pre-2007-8 situation with the credit collapse where something that you knew about. But you know, do you know right before that credit collapse, the banks knew about this possibility of an what they call correlation, like these interlocking credit defaults between banks. Do you know what they said just like a couple months before that happened in 2007-8?
It's too big to fail.
It's too big to fail. Quite literally. Only about a 1 in a million chance that this they knew there's a slight chance of what they call correlation between all these systems and all the assets collapse at the same time. Okay. They knew it was – they said it was about a 1 in a million chance. If you listen to the physicists that they were employing at the
time. Somebody always wins the lottery though, dude.
Someone wins the lottery and that 1 out of a million chance happens to us in our life.
And it happens pretty regular. It happens almost weekly.
Because it wasn't 1 in a million. It was underestimating the risk and it was more like 1 out of 50.
Yeah.
And it's just going to happen. 1 out of 50, you're going to come up, you know, all heads.
Yeah.
So this is –
yeah. And that's just it. Like, once again, 1 out of a million. That's funny because
it just happens.
It happens weekly.
And this is what you get by ignoring these topics going all the way back to Roswell and the different Air Force projects that were designed to cover it up. Project Sign did a good job. Their engineers. Mm. I mean, as people have pointed out, the Roswell researcher, Don Schmidt, points out in his book. About Roswell, Children of Roswell, and his other book. Yeah. He points out that the people in Project Sign were not theoretical physicists that had just been hired, you know, sitting back somewhere looking, thinking. These were the people that ran Wright Patt Reverse Engineering Lab that reverse engineered German and Soviet planes. These were nuts and bolts engineers.
Yeah.
They signed on to the idea that this material that they were looking at from Roswell was extraterrestrial. That's what Project Sign was nuts and bolts engineers.
Well, and, you know, when it comes down to it, to to bring that to another light. You know, when you're talking about the trust, and especially the trust of the conversation, Dr. Simeon, and where we're going to go without this conversation, and what will be stymied, you know, I guarantee you, I'm going on 50. If you went and talked to my grandparents and even my mom, there is a level of trust for their government the people of my generation and under do not have. Because we've seen the things from their generation. We've seen what happened in my mom's generation, and then we've seen what happened in ours and after. We've got the perspective of both sides of it, not just the perspective of we all had to come together to win World War II, like I was out collecting tin cans, you know, victory gardens, everything else, everybody coming together for the trust and the love of their country. And then that going on to the next generation and a couple things happening, a couple of rifts here and there, you know, sociologically. And it's interesting to see that and to see the fact of that distrust for government is literally where we will get with science. We'll get there.
No, and this is what Stanton Friedman pointed out, you know, who I think Stanton, is he was related to Kathleen Martin? Was that his niece?
I believe so. Something like that.
Yeah. So Stanton wrote a book called Science Was Wrong. People have to read this book. Stan passed on a couple of years ago. I got to speak to him a bunch of times. He always gave great lectures, and he always pointed out that no one believed in the Wright brothers, right? They had to go to France to get support because our government was supporting Samuel Langley with his houseboat-sized plane that never worked.
Yeah.
But two
bicycle
mechanics.
Keep shoving him off the end of a carrier, giving him money.
In the Potomac. In the Potomac.
Yeah.
And, they were funded with $100,000.
A lot of money.
Samuel, I think he was he was associated with Harvard. He was an astrophysicist, whatever they would have called it at the time. He was someone that was involved with planetary sciences. And the Wright brothers being
high school dropouts. Yeah.
High school dropouts, self-funded from their bicycle business. And no one believed it at the time. Those articles said that they were hoaxers, just like what you – so if you read Stanton's book, Science Was Wrong, he goes through the entire history of science, Louis and Hope, that all of this were – the mainstream just didn't believe what turned out to be real. He pointed out that the New York Times didn't even admit that they were wrong about space travel until the astronauts were on their way to the moon in the first Apollo mission. So this is – we know this is true, and you can't help – Stanton had a great argument here. It's science has been wrong so many times. It's not always right, and it's often wrong.
Hey, my son doesn't have Pluto on his planetary chart.
Yeah, what happened to Pluto?
It's in my astronomy book from high school that's out in the garage.
What happened to Pluto?
Yeah.
So the idea of what's real changes, and it's this ossified bureaucracy that we've all – grown up around.
And it's rooted itself in science.
Yeah. And I think it was, I forgot who gave this response recently. Was it Stanton Friedman or someone else like him who said that science is going to be the big loser when UFOs turn out to be proven to be real, wherever they're from, whether it's multidimensional or ultra dimensional?
Yeah.
Hal wrote a paper about the ultra-terrestrial theory.
Yep.
Some other species, other life on our planet that we actually don't know much about.
Yeah.
Well, whatever science is going to be the loser here because they have been pushing this away for decades unnecessarily. That we could have had these discussions honestly without the circus atmosphere of ridicule.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've had in this country, Chris, it hasn't been so bad in other countries. Russia was never anti-UFO. Soviet Union wasn't anti-UFO. China has officially sanctioned UFO research.
Yep.
I went to the citizen hearing in 2013 in D.C. Remember the citizen hearing?
Oh, yeah.
I spoke with some of those generals and military officials from Latin America. And, you know, they told me we go into our schools and tell kids that the OVNIs are real. I mean, they have a totally different approach. It's somehow, for whatever reasons, it's a whole big discussion of why we became so clandestine about the UFO subject. Do you think it was just that they were worried about a Soviet psychological warfare, scaring people with this phenomena or whatever it is? But we're long past that Cold War era. And it doesn't serve us anymore to push these subjects under the rug when even people like Hal Puthoff, who's been involved in these programs within the U.S. government, classified UFO research programs.
Yeah,
there's a lot of good science to be discovered here. We're just touching on the surface here of all the interesting science, whether it's dark matter, variable speeds of light, which is something Einstein proposed, by the way, but was forgotten because he was so well known for.
Well, all anybody ever remembers is the C.
Yeah.
But they forget about the quantification of the C.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's in a vacuum.
It was Paul Dirac who proposed the idea of negative probabilities. And at the time, no one thought that would mean anything. What's a negative probability? It turned out to be antimatter. And it was discovered in cosmic rays, positively charged electrons. It was discovered a couple of years after Dirac proposed this. But at the time, he suffered a lot of ridicule for proposing the idea of antimatter, but it turned out to be real. I mean, so what we're seeing is just what science has gone through. It's not the textbook picture we were taught. There's a lot of real hostility to people with different ideas.
Well, and, you know, that is something that we sadly talk about on this show regularly, Dr. B. I think it is it's the root of a lot of the conversation that's happening now in a lot of these what would be called fringe fields of science, you know, and the fact of, yes, these things have been ridiculed for years. Yes, witnesses for UFOs, UAPs have been ridiculed for years. Even professional witnesses, people that we trust with multi-million-dollar machines. Like, we just found out that whenever you take out a $200 hobby balloon, they use a $400,000 missile and one missed.
So one missed. So that was almost $1 million to take out a, what were we told? It was a $10.
Yeah. They could be bought for as cheap as $15, depending on what you're doing.
We spent $1 million to take down. This sounds like what Russia's doing in Ukraine. They spend all that manpower to take
Hashtag overwhelming force.
2,000, they lose 2,000 guys per 100 meters. It's not sustainable. Why are we spending $1 million to take down a $15 balloon? I still don't understand this.
Well, what you have to remember and what we say on the show all the time is what the conversation leads to and where the conversation goes. Right. And the conversation with this, the conversation with UFO UEP, with disclosure and the fact that there is now a annual UFO UAP report.
Yeah.
That should tell you what it's about. Because they ain't trying to study it once and be done with it. We need to put regular money into this.
And we need to remember researchers who got us to this point where we're even having this conversation.
Oh, what about absolutely.
Mark McCandlish? What happened to Mark McCandlish? He was I heard him talk many times. He was on Chris Ventura's channel, Alternative Propulsion. He was a couple of weeks away from testifying in one of these classified hearings about UAP. And then we're told he takes his own life. I mean, people do this, and I know this is unfortunate, and we wish we could have conversations with people before they do this. But why do researchers like him, why do they disappear like that right before they're supposed to testify in front of Congress? And he was so enthusiastic. Mark loved this topic. So anyway, there's a lot of researchers who've disappeared over the years.
Yeah. You want to see some frightening numbers? Go look at the number of NASA scientists that have died. Like, that's just a disturbing number. It's one of those, like, wow, if you did the odds on that, that'd be some creepy odds, man. And nobody would ever want to go be a NASA scientist.
So this is just another reason why we need to have a serious discussion about this very soon. One of the people featured in my Black Swan Ghost book, by the way, is a man named Richard Hoover. And I have a chapter on Richard Hoover in Black Swan Ghosts. He was an exobiologist. He studied life, cellular life forms that are really tough, that can live in
tardigrades, things like that.
Yes, tardigrades.
Extremophiles.
He was an expert in – he had 300 peer-reviewed papers and 30 patents, and he worked as NASA's chief exobiologist looking at organisms living in volcanic vents, nuclear reactors, and what he claimed were fossils of single-celled organisms living in meteorites. And he got so much flack from NASA by saying that some of these meteorites contained not just amino acids, but literal fossils. NASA would always argue, well, those were fossils were from contamination, you know, from the rock pick you used to open up the meteorite, something like that. But what really
bugged cross contamination.
Yeah, that's what they, but that's not what really bothered him. What bothered him is they told him not to talk about this anymore. They just told him, we don't want you going to conferences anymore. Because it's just makes us look bad to talk about extraterrestrial life. And he finally said, well, who's bothered by this? And they said, the White House. The White House has told us they don't want to hear any more talk about extraterrestrial life. Yes, you read about this now, and now they're getting to the point where they're saying, well, there's amino acids in these meteorites. I just saw this in Science Magazine last week.
I post things on our Curious Realm group all the time. And whenever I posted that, I was like, one more proof of panspermia.
Well, panspermia. So this is what Richard Hoover would talk about. And his view to me as a, you know, very eminent biologist, he spoke at the UFO Congress in outside of Scottsdale at one of those meetings. That's how I got to talk to him. He quit. He quit over this. He said, I'm not, no one tells me what I can say at conferences. So this is how bad the situation is, Chris, is that you have the scientists that are open-minded to these topics. And he was open-minded. He wasn't a UFO specialist, but he was definitely open to the idea, having worked with NASA, having overheard the internal conversations.
Yeah.
Like other people that have worked at NASA. He was definitely open to the idea that these UFOs could be coming from an extraterrestrial source. He had this from the Skylab tapes that we heard when the Skylab astronaut said, hey, we're seeing this thing out the window. Mm-hmm. And he was told that the pictures would be available. They snapshots. And then he's later told, oh, the film was accidentally destroyed. He got very suspicious. So I'm just saying, people like him, if you keep losing people like him because you're not open to his point of view, looking at the evidence, you have got a type of de facto censorship going on.
Mm. Yeah.
So this is really true. And this is just one example of someone I came across that quit versus being told they couldn't talk about exobiology.
Yeah. And there's been numerous cases like that. I mean, the one that springs to mind immediately is Richard C. Hoagland, hashtag dream guest. If you're out there listening, Richard, but yeah, there's been numerous scientists that have worked for NASA that later left because of this consternation and the walls that they put up to progress on certain things.
Yeah. And remember Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project?
Oh, yeah.
You had Donna Hare worked there, who saw that, she said she saw the people that were doing the covering up the photos.
Yeah. Yeah. The actual airbrush lab.
The strippers. They called themselves strippers because they would strip out the weird objects.
Yeah. So the anomalies.
Yeah. So the public wouldn't get confused. Ken Johnson, another astronaut from NASA, talked about. Donna Hare talked about this at the Disclosure press conference. And there was Sergeant Ken, was it Sergeant Wolf?
Mm.
Ken Wolf was his name?
Yep.
He's passed on now. He said he apparently had a he was a bicyclist, and he apparently got hit by an 18-wheeler up there, I think in Vermont. But he talked about this too, about going in an NRO facility, and someone came up and said, hey, you want to see this? And they looked, and Ken apparently said, well, what is this? And the guy said, we think that there's structures on the moon. And he showed and then, you know, the conversation ended when other NASA employees came. So we've heard people from NASA saying this. I mean, respected NASA employees saying that there are these photo manipulation labs that the public doesn't see the actual photos. We see what's been, you know, doctored.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, And granted, I do a lot of astrophotography in my backyard. I don't have a single photo that I haven't touched. However, going through and reducing noise and getting rid of a piece of dust on the lens is different than erasing entire swaths.
Well, that is what Ken Johnson said happened with the moon photos.
There's a difference
photos.
Between a retouch.
No. So if you look at Ken Johnson, he was another speaker at the UFO. He said the same thing, is that he saw some of these originals at NASA, NASA events in their conference rooms, in the rooms where they would give slideshows to other NASA employees about what. And he said there was one day they showed them of something in a crater which looked very symmetrical and artificially illuminated from the inside. And then a couple days later, it's gone. The same photo, you request it from NASA Photo Central, and it's gone. It's been airbrushed out.
Wow.
So it's again, this is really, again, we're talking about real large scale black swan events here. When this becomes a public discussion, what those of us who've been going to these conferences have been privy to, which I imagine now for the skeptics is what Congress, the Intel committees on Congress, are hearing about this supposed 23-minute long video of everything that apparently looks like a sci-fi movie, of everything they've recorded from military cameras and satellites and stuff. And so I imagine at some point we're going to be hearing about this. And again, it's not like we didn't warn you. It's just that there's been a lot of inertia and reticence.
Not like there wasn't a 2% chance the whole time.
Yeah, and eventually, you know, that when the musical chairs stop – you know, you got to sit down. Someone's going to be left without the chair, and eventually it's going to be NASA or one of these organizations where we say, like, guys, the data's been there the whole time. You just chose, for whatever reason, to kick the can down the road.
Well, yeah, and at some point it comes down to the point of, once again, the conversation of trust. And if we don't have the conversation now, where will the trust be later?
Right. Now, this is what we're talking about. Those of us, like you and I, that care about this, we're not pushing any agenda here. What we're concerned about is some sort of collapse from not having the adult discussion we should have been having.
Yeah.
The 2%, the snake eyes showing up on your dice.
Yeah. Proof or no proof of Sasquatch, I don't care. It does not change my paradigm.
Yeah.
I want to know why we're not researching it. I want to know why there's a 2% deviation in the science and yet still people are saying it isn't.
Okay, you know, I had a friend come visit me in Boulder. I hadn't seen her in about 10 years. We used to do remote viewing together. We learned to see. Yeah. So she came up while I was writing Dark Matter Monsters. She said to me, I'd just like to come and hang out. And again, we can look at old remote viewing sessions. And she came up here and stayed. And there's plenty of places to stay around here, you know, beautiful Airbnbs and so on. So we're talking. She sees I'm writing Dark Matter Monsters. And she tells me later, you know, Simeon, I kind of was not into that topic, but I didn't tell you, but I just was kind of listening along because I'm a friend of yours and I was listening, but I didn't really buy it. Well, guess what? She goes back on the way home. She decides to stop at her family's summer vacation cottage in the hills of Pine Top, Colorado, not too far from Snowflake, where Travis Walton had his encounter, right? That neck of the woods in Arizona?
Yeah.
Guess what? She sees the tree structures. I had talked about the tree structures. She starts seeing them around the property. She realizes those howling sounds at night were not ordinary animal sounds, that the weird smell of a dog smell around the place was not a wet dog. And then one day she's meditating. She opens her eyes and there's a Sasquatch right out the picture window looking right back at her. Right back at
her. Wow.
It was 5 or 6 feet tall, squatting. She said when it stood up, that's exactly right. She started seeing those. She had seen them around. You know what she thought these were, Chris?
Tree fall.
Boy Scouts.
Yeah, sure.
She had never seen any Boy Scouts, but what is
somebody
your mind
building a temporary structure?
Exactly. Yeah. Temporary shelters for Boy Scouts. So I had shown her pictures. I said, I haven't seen one of these tree structures. Believe me, I look for them when I'm hiking. I haven't seen them. But
same.
All of a sudden, the pieces of the puzzle came together. She had been a little concerned of that this could be going on, but then she said, oh, come on, I don't believe in these things. And she went back up by herself and she opens her eyes and there's one squatting 100 feet from the picture window. And when she said it stood up, it was at least 12 feet tall.
Wow.
Completely black fur, huge eyes. they've got a pretty intense stare when they're staring at you.
No.
And it frightened her so much that they sold the condo. I mean, they didn't want to go back. And so she went from being a skeptic and a friend of mine, but like an, you know, just a
to
friendly
a fearful
skeptic.
Believer.
Yeah. To someone that realized that they're out there. So this is what happens with the denial of the evidence. And I'm not blaming people for this.
No,
I probably was in the same camp a couple of years ago. You could say, well, those tree structures, that's some temporary dwelling of Boy Scouts. And
yeah, some hobo passing through.
It's a wet dog around the neighborhood that smells like a skunk. And, you know, those howling sounds, that's some sort of, well, I don't know. It's just it's a coyote. You can rationalize it all the way until one day they're looking at you through the picture window. It's what happened to her. And she, by the way, she gave me permission to talk about this, but to share that story. But she went from being an, you know, just a friendly skeptic to someone that ran. I mean, Chris, she ran.
She
out of
sold
the
a home, man. Like that's a process.
That's a process.
That's a process. Like you are committed with your decision that you saw something out that window when you decide to sell a home.
Let me tell you about the 2% here. She was so frightened by seeing the Sasquatch looking at her. Wow. She didn't even take her laptop. She didn't lock the doors or turn the lights out. She headed for the garage and she said she went 60 miles an hour out of the garage. This is what we're talking about.
Wow. Wow.
This is what happens when you don't have adult conversations. Even the Native Americans would talk about the Sasquatch. They didn't really know what they were either, but they at least said they have respect for them. Just like avoid them. Yeah. Like don't make eye contact. Don't make a lot of noise at night. Just leave them alone. They'll leave you alone.
Yeah.
That was generally the Native American attitude for the most part with some variation on that. But because we haven't talked about it and you finally they're looking at you 100 feet away, they're 12 feet tall. Okay. Massive, like a linebacker with fur. In a fur coat or something. This is can you imagine not taking your laptop? I mean, how frightened she was. She
leaving all your personals behind and just grabbing keys and leaving.
I heard from her a week ago or so. She said she just took her first hike again outdoors. She didn't hike for a year.
Wow. Wow.
So this is how serious this is, and this is going to happen to us with the UFO phenomenon. We don't come to terms with what we're dealing with here. A lot of people are going to be in her situation where they, even being friendly skeptics or maybe not so friendly, and it's going to be right there in front of you. It's going to be hovering over your house or whatever you're going to encounter. So I just say let's start the conversation now rather than have a panic later, which leads to some sort of social collapse.
Hold on. There you go.
Enough said. Chris, we're going to continue this conversation another time. It's been
amazing. Really I want to thank you for your time.
I want to get in more detail about any of these. I have so much evidence. This all started for me with remote viewing, which we didn't talk about. But we can go through that. We can go through crop circles, how it led to the UFOs. And finally, to something I never would have thought I would have believed in, cryptids, which I – believe me, I know they're real now. I know they're real, but a couple of years ago, I would have thought, are you serious? No, it's serious. Believe me, I've spoken to enough people who have witnessed it, just like my friend from Arizona. It's serious when you encounter them on a trail or something. I'm about to interview another witness tomorrow that actually had their car damaged by boulders that thing threw at them. So you don't think there's evidence? There's evidence.
You are actively appearing in some upcoming material. Tell us a little bit about that before you go. Thank and then we will, of course, have time for shameless self-promotion, Doctor.
Yes. Well, first of all, thanks for a great interview. And you're very knowledgeable about these topics, which people like me always appreciate when the host knows something. And you know a lot about this.
Thank you.
So about a year ago, I came across this movie called A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed. And I watched it with my girlfriend, and we thought it was really good. We liked the drone photography, and we especially enjoyed the psychiatrist towards the end, who said that not only will you have PTSD from an encounter, you could with a Sasquatch. Because, again, it's different physics. You're not ready for this. Your conscious mind rationalizes it. But they said you may not even remember your encounters, which was incredible thing to think about, that you won't remember it. You'll have missing time. Which I know people have missing time in the woods. Maybe this is what happened to them. I don't know. They don't remember anything. All they know is a couple hours are gone. But the producers of this film found out about my book, Dark Matter Monsters. And they contacted me. And so I'm going to be actually in the sequel to A Flash of Beauty.
Awesome.
Called A Flash. I'm told the working title is A Flash of Beauty, The Paranormal Bigfoot, which is what Dark Matter Monsters is all about. Is why paranormal is real. Why we were talking about it, permittivity and dark matter, and fractal electromagnetic arrangements and so forth. This is all the science behind it. So this apparently is coming out on Memorial Day, I'm told, if it's on schedule. And I think this could be really interesting because all I know is they were Brett and his crew were very open-minded in this conversation like we're having now, just like this.
Yeah.
And we had some real good conversation about it. So I think it could be and I'm told there's some really good witnesses in this sequel film. So watch out for that.
I can't wait. The first was so well done, so incredibly well put together. The data in it was phenomenal. And I cannot wait to see your contribution to this material, Doctor. Thank you so much for your time once again. I'd love to have you on again and again and again. Please do hold the line while we close things out here in the segment and head on out to commercial. While you are online checking out the amazing work of the good doctor over at mountbaldly.com, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all the episodes. That is, of course, where you can follow us on social media. It's where you can find us on all the video platforms, audio platforms. It's where you can follow our RSS feed. If you are an experiencer and have seen anything in the world of paranormal, cryptid, UFO, UAP, stop on by CuriousRealm.com/story. You can share your story with us. We will pose your story to our professionals, to our researchers, and maybe get you a little bit more information about it. Stay tuned after these messages, folks. We will be right back with more great interviews right after this. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7%. Off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training, and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is PodcastCadet.com.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially WebWorks Wireless. If you're looking for wireless connections for your camp, RV, traveling rig, like myself, stop on by WebWorks Wireless today. They are your source for unlimited, unthrottled internet anywhere that you have cell phone signal. Absolutely amazing service. With them, I have loved using their product all around the country and helping them benchmark that. So stop on by and check them out, folks. That is WebWorks Wireless. While you are online checking out WebWorks Wireless, make sure to stop on by the website of our guest for this segment, the Pattern.pub. We will be talking in this segment with Kevin Jeffers about the book, The Pattern, An Exploration of Consciousness. Welcome to the show, Kevin. How are you today?
I'm very good. I think today is a good day to chat.
It's always a good day to chat.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
I've been interested in your book since Michelle got us together and everything. I actually have my hardcover, or not my hardcover, but my hard copy coming in the mail as we speak. But I've been going through and reading a little bit here on the Kindle version. Before we get into things, go ahead and introduce yourself to the audience, who you are, and how you got into this world of study of the pattern and what the pattern is, Kevin.
Well, I got involved in, generally speaking, shifting consciousness when I was about 18 years old. And that's probably 50 years ago. So in the interim, I've been developing connection skills and healing skills and a number of different approaches to reaching out and contacting or being with people, friends that I want to help, if I can use the word help, or facilitate their understanding of what their potentiality is.
Okay.
So it's been going on for a long time, and I just view it as improving, improving, and improving, so that when I come to my transition time, I go through it rather simply and directly into the light. That's been my motivator and goal for a very long time. A lot of people who pass, they get stuck in the, it's like a band of energy around the earth where their soul gets stuck and they don't know how to go to the lights.
Mm.
So the pattern has been about, looking deeper into consciousness based upon what I experienced during a meditation and trying to find my way through the outer levels and into hyper-consciousness.
And it's interesting that you bring that up. We've been talking a lot about extended consciousness with people on the show lately. We've been talking a lot about astral travel, going other places other than our local reality. And when you're talking about these things, it can be really hard to explain to some people.
Yeah.
We just had a whole conversation in the previous segment with Dr. Hine about the fact of non-local realities and perturbations in things like a fractal world. And
yes,
when you're talking about moving over to the other side, helping people get ready to move and transition to the other side.
Yes.
How has that journey been for you? And how has that mission been received by family and friends alike, Kevin?
Well, it makes a difference when you tell your friend that I'm going to show up in the morning or whatever, usually early hours of the morning. That's when I meditate. I said, I'll show up. I'll walk through wherever you are. And if you're not conscious, if you're asleep, I'll give you a physical description of your house and houses that I've never been into. And that usually lets them know that things are going in the right direction. And sometimes it's as simple as people wake up and there I am standing next to them. And that's a part of the interesting thing of multiple realities is that our consciousness operates in simultaneous realities all the time.
Mm.
We're shifting in and out of consciousness from a very basic form to a higher form, and a higher form meaning to me, the higher frequencies that people express, either in the body or out of the body. For me, Chris, it's all about your frequency.
Yeah. And I was going to ask how important, especially whenever it comes to frequency, because I mean, you can, I personally am a highly energetic person. I can see when my energy is disturbing my wife. unintentionally and utterly unintentionally. But
sure.
you have to be aware that, and I say it on the show all the time, we are all responsible for the vibration that we drag into the room with us.
Yes.
It's no different than having the conversation on the way to the table. You've pretty much come to the table with your mind made up at that point. And I guess my question here is, how important is acceptance to being able to move on, to being able to be a part of this frequency that you're talking about, Kevin?
Well, the key to that for me is intention. How energetic, how directed, how clear is your intention that you want to do a certain thing? If you don't have an intention, say you just sit down in your chair and go into meditative posture and you reach inside, you're pretty much going to get a flat response.
Okay.
Because you've not molded, you've not created the intention to reach out of yourself. And it's not an easy thing. Some people are born with it. Some people are not. Some people develop it just during the events of their life. And I found that it's directly related to the energetic intent. How well can you shape and create your intent? And that's something probably you learn over time, which I have been learning over time.
Yeah. And that is, of course, a topic that we talk about regularly on the show, the concept of manifestation and being able, because, I mean, some people, God bless them, Kevin, they go their whole life and don't realize that, you know, you could change probably about 70% of those woes on a dime. If you chose to basically submit into the system of what you call the pattern, what I call just the universe in general. And it's not a zero sum system. It's not a zero sum, but not a zero return system. You know, it's a,
the pattern in my mind was put in place a long time ago by what I call the originators. They're the originators of consciousness on the planet. The pattern is the underlying structure of self-consciousness as created and placed by the originators of all different forms of consciousness resident in our galaxy. So give an example of that.
Please.
Hey, whales. You hear a lot about whales. Well, I didn't really think that whales were something other than large mammals that swam in the water. And so one time I came in contact with a whale, and their communication is their singing. And that was life-changing for me in terms of seeing consciousness in all other forms. And then as I got older and I reached out, I could see consciousness to some degree, to some level, in all things. And that brought me to the concept of we're all interrelated. We're interrelated energetically.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that was exactly a lot of the conversation with our previous guest on this exact episode, is the fact of we are all related energetically, whether you choose to be or not. Just by sheer physics alone, we are related energetically. The example I give on the show regularly, Kevin, is you and I right now, despite distance apart, are sharing an electron shell.
Yes.
You know, all of this
we have and we always will. Too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, precisely. Because that energy can't dissipate. It can change form, but it can't be technically destroyed.
Consciousness is not hemmed in by time or space.
Yeah.
You can be existing within a past life or your own life in the past, in the future, because it's all happening simultaneously. And consciousness is an integral part of the universe, and it is not open to dissolution or death or cessation. Consciousness is forever. There is no limit to the expression of your consciousness until you get to the point where, okay, I've been on the earth a long time, many people, hundreds of thousands of years, as strange as that sounds. Eventually, people get unstuck from the wants and needs and desires of their everyday life and seek something more.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, people seek these things in different ways, Kevin. A lot of people, church is what works for them. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people also close minds off, not just because of church, but otherwise as well. Even those in the esoteric world, paranormal world, they will definitely close their mind to somebody of church faith and church belief. And to me, I guess, as somebody who started off in college in the Catholic Church as a seminarian, moving on into my world of youth ministry and now not even being involved in any of that, I choose to see things in the light of whatever works for you. I'd love to say that those 300 people in a mass on Sunday morning are doing it wrong. As long as they are getting something out of it and bettering themselves and coming closer to the capital U universe and truth that we know, I don't think they're doing it wrong at all. They may not be as enlightened as the other. They may not be able to manifest things in their life in a magical way yet or ever at all. But that doesn't mean that they aren't spiritually happy. and fulfilled?
From my experience, Chris, spirit, which is that ephemeral form of consciousness that overlooks our life, is not judgmental.
Yeah.
Whatever you do is integrated into the pattern, the greater pattern, and the infinite pattern, which is your life. So if you focus on church and prayers and pleading, that's okay.
Yeah.
Because you're learning how to reach out and connect. The people that close their minds are living in a box. They cannot get out of the box. Their paradigm, their frame of reference in their reality is within the confines of that box. Those are the people that distress me because they're missing their life. When I look at people from an energetic point of view during a healing process, it's clear what the imprints of that, of those beliefs are.
Yeah. Yeah. And how often, whenever you work with people in a healing aspect, how often do you find that their belief changes? And by belief, I'm not saying in any particular religion or anything else, but more in the concept of greater than, you know, something greater than yourself.
Well, in the healing process, I move into their energetic field only with their permission. I won't go near anyone's energetic field without, okay, Kevin,
yeah,
I'm all right with this. So I move into their energetic field and you see all the layers of reality that they're experiencing at this moment in time. Their past, their present, their potentiality for the future. So it's within that frame that I can do something like tickle their consciousness, have them experience fully the moment in time that they're experiencing it. And that's very important to the healing process. This healing does not occur. A lot of people don't stand behind this, but healing does not occur unless it's in concurrence with your spirit.
Mm.
Your spirit might think, well, Kevin has to learn a few more things about pain or life disruption. We'll continue this until we can get to the point where he can lift out of that need and want for that experience.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, just because you have psychologically dealt something or come to terms with it does not mean that your time of spiritual battle or spiritual upheaval because of it is done. At all.
Yes. I run across my own life all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I think
that I just don't know what I'm experiencing.
Yeah.
And I have to go back until I get a better shape of what I'm experiencing. But initially, I might not know what the heck is going on.
Oh, yeah.
And that's disruptive to me because it kind of puts a little twist in my reality. Is this real? Is it not real? Is this your imagination? Is this your emotion? Are your emotions creating events and circumstances? So it's a discerning process of sorting through everything that you experience. And a lot of that, I think, comes just down to maturity and where your head is at in your heart.
Well, and personal and real examination, raw examination, being able and willing to pull no punches with yourself and accept responsibility even for what you've taken part in, even for harboring this and giving it safe harbor, you know?
When these occur, you have to step into them.
Yeah.
You have to be like a boxer, or that's my best analogy.
Yeah.
You have to step into the event or the experience. Or if you step back, you just create distance.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But stepping forward, and really, things changed for me when I became brutally honest with myself.
Yep.
Something happened, some event, I said something, people reacted. The brutality of truth must be embraced to experience higher degrees of consciousness. You have to tell yourself the truth all the time, whether you like it or not.
Well, it makes you. Yeah, and once again, being responsible for your own energy and what you're bringing in somewhere. If you aren't responsible and accountable for your actions, for what you do, for even for the fact of like, wow, I'm in this situation because of me right now, you're never going to be able to fix that, and you're never going to be able to stop it next time it happens, or even recognize it possibly.
What I see is every time we deny who we are.
Yeah.
We create layers of unavailability to spirit.
Yeah.
Spirit knows that we want to lift our consciousness into participation of the spiritual world. That's who we are. That's how we're made. That's the frame of the pattern. The pattern is the teacher. Pattern is the tool that we use and spirit uses to what I call uplift. We need to uplift our consciousness to include all forms of life and reality, at the same time being absolutely truthful with ourselves.
Mm.
There's no one that's going to really respond to you in a meaningful way if you're just talking, or you're talking from beliefs, or you're not talking from your experience.
Yeah. Yeah. How important is it, especially with the pattern, to, I guess, be ready to accept the, not necessarily the responsibility for things, but being open to seeing, I guess, the insanity of ourselves and our want to be comfortable in a pattern,
yeah.
You know, in a pattern in the opposite way, whether it be a pattern of addiction, a pattern of abuse, what yeah. have you, you know, those are all things that we relinquish our consent to. We put our consent into a system to be a part of that. Is the pattern passive and people are just missing out on it? Or is it an active conscious choice that you have to make, like Fight Club? You choose your level of involvement.
Well, it's my personal experience that this becomes more real when people read the book that I wrote, because my descriptions, as we're doing right now, are fall somewhat short of the impact and reality of how we are intertwined with spirit in consciousness. There's no end of the road for us. It just continues and continues and continues until we're tired of it. We don't need it. We lift ourselves out. Going back to what you said before, pursuing your beliefs creates a sense of delusion. You cannot see the clarity of spirit if you're telling yourself stories.
Yeah.
And the stories are, well, God is real. The devil is real. Well, in fact, there's no devil. There's the devil in our consciousness, and there's the God in our consciousness. And this is kind of a rough part, because I had a Jesuit training myself, is to fully express who I am, where I am, when I am, to learn about myself, which in turn is the key for lifting out of this earth energy system. The Tibetans have an interesting thing in the Book of the Dead about how we enter into a period or a place of delusion, of Maya, of images, of thoughts that stand between us and the experience of spirit. The Tibetans, and I spent many years traveling there, the monks, at least, always live their life as their death is the most important experience in their life. And they don't want to get caught here because of the delusions that they've created in their daily lives.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, especially whenever you're talking spiritual healing, once again, moving forward, not only in your life, but preparing yourself to move forward on the ultimate spiritual journey, becoming pure spirit. You know, I can think of no greater adventure, quite honestly, Kevin. Now, I'm not going to say I won't be afraid or fearful. I mean, heck, I get butterflies and fearful before I hop onto a roller coaster, but sure as fuck after.
You're human, and that's the way it happens.
Yeah, and I expect that. But it's also one of those spiritually, I look forward to that journey. I look forward to being one with knowledge and being able to influence the universe in a grander way than I can in this, as Augustine would say, sinful flesh sack. It's strange because not everybody is comfortable talking about something like this, Kevin. Now, yeah, because a lot of what you're saying, especially with the pattern, is once again in preparation to meet the light.
Yeah. The problem with avoiding everything is that one day you will encounter that.
Yeah.
That's the way it is. We are born, we live, and we die. So being afraid of death, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense because I'm going there anyhow.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't matter what or think or write about. I will be heading someday into death and released from the physical body. So how do I prepare my soul to move into the light if I'm still operating under the delusion of life?
Mm.
It won't happen. Eventually people get stuck because they just don't know where to go. And that's a function of physical health, mental delusion, chemicals, violent death, accidental death. They're so shocking that people don't know how to proceed.
Mm.
But generally, family members come and embrace them and pull them into the light. But there's always that percentage, even 3-5% over the years, is hundreds of millions of people who have not released themselves from the earth. That's why when I chat with people, the idea of ghosts are so real. They say, I feel something. I said, yes. The Earth energy system is crammed full of people that need to be released, helped in their release in their journey into the light.
And once again, not a comfortable conversation for most people, Kevin.
Never, Chris, never. Just talking about death makes people nuts.
And
talk about it.
Well, what I'd like to talk about is, I guess, the conversation with the lost spirits, the ones that have been left behind, that haven't, I guess, as the Tibetans would say, dealt with the karma in their life, whatever baggage they left laying behind or whatever baggage they were dragging behind with them, they haven't been able to leave that in order to move on and become part of that light. So how does that conversation begin for you, Kevin?
I did this soul retrieval exercise for many, many years. And then I started moving out of my locale and into different areas. And eventually I ran across war. Example, Syria, where bombing of buildings, and now in Ukraine, are killing a lot of children. And say you're 5 years old, and suddenly everything goes dark. And then you realize that you're not contained by your body anymore. But that's almost useless data because you don't know what you're experiencing. So as a youngster who experiences sudden and violent death, by war in particular, other situations, but that's the one we can wrap our head around.
Yeah.
What do they do? What do I do? Not meaning me, they. What do I do? And they don't know what to do. So how can you move into the light when you don't have a direction?
Or when you can't even reconcile or reason what it was that was going on because you don't have that concept in your psyche yet. You don't, at 5 years old, you don't know what war is.
You don't know anything except for eating, wow, sleep, and ultimately pain. There is no direct path to the light for younger people. So sometimes the family members that have passed on come back and retrieve them, which is great. And sometimes they just don't know where to go.
You know, it just dawned on me real quick, the phenomenological pattern of things like poltergeist activity, mm-hmm, things like that, normally attributed with children or spirits or even adolescents, like living in the house, causing that to happen.
Children are open to the experiences of spirit.
Yeah. Well, even if it's child spirits that are doing it, the idea of no different than a child psychologically, you know, lashing out or punching people at school because they don't know how to process the emotions that they're having, you know, because they don't have that coping mechanism. It would be that energy would still not have the coping mechanism. So it would make sense a lot that, like, the spirit is throwing a temper tantrum right now.
Yeah.
As opposed to most hauntings that you see where, you know, on occasion you'll see or hear a kid playing, things like that. But you don't hear about older ghosts, you know, like, oh, yeah, we have this spirit that's 60 years old and she tends to throw things around the house. You know, it just dawned on me that that would be an interesting set of data points to put together with hauntings.
Have any limitations when their experience of consciousness? They don't understand that they're supposed to behave a certain way, think a certain way, before life in a certain. They just don't know. So all children are open to the experience that you mentioned, from the guys to simply, they have friends that they talk to. They create amazing things just because their friend taught them how to do it. And parents get distressed because they think, what do I do? They're talking about their friend. We all know that spiritual friends don't exist. We all know that ghosts don't exist, but they continue to exist. And then all of us, at some point, enter into a fuller life and leave behind the experiences of younger life. If you're fortunate, you bring it forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And, interesting to see that, as you're saying, translate into the spiritual world and into the world of passing into the light. The same things that keep us from psychologically moving forward in the world around us can be the same things that spiritually keep us from moving forward and meeting that proper great beyond.
I like working with children because they have no preconceptions. They don't know what they can and can't do. And they're open to whatever they experience until they start to close down, usually between the ages of 5 and 8. So I like to focus on recovering children because children have really not made the linkage between life and death, living and cessation. What is right? What is wrong? Well, maybe they have some sense of what is right and wrong because mom and dad taught them what's wrong, right and wrong. But they just don't know. Children don't know. And also older people, much older people, don't know. I don't know what your experiences are, but many, many older people, when they're dying, their consciousness is barely present.
Yeah. Yeah.
But on the other hand, then they have periods of cognition. They have periods of becoming awakened spirit. But mostly they don't know. And if you die not knowing, where the heck are you going to go?
Yeah. Yeah, and even considering that many elderly, as they move forward in age begin to regress and become almost childlike in their, not only in their mentality, but in their retention as well.
Their capacities are diminishing as they get older and older. They're still there. That spirit's who they are. The soul is still there. And the soul is experiencing this diminishment of capabilities and awareness. Is that's a part of life. Death is a part of life. A fuller experience of death is to experience life.
Now, out of the soul retrievals you've done, Kevin, just out of off the cuff, what percentage would you say are children?
Well, for me, it's probably 90% because that's all I pay attention to.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You have choices. You ask spirit to direct you to a retrieval with the understanding that my preference is to go find children who have died and lead them into the life. So it's a preference, nothing more than that.
Okay. Okay.
Not like a blanket check, you know, that pays for everything.
Yeah.
Is very specific.
Now, do you find, because I'm sure that you've done retrievals and spirit has sent you to other things as well that you need to help, do you find that children are easier to work with or harder when it comes to the retrieval work?
They're wide open to the experience, but they're also a little hesitant, suspicious, because they don't know you.
Mm.
You show up in spirit and they're in spirit, but they don't know really they're in spirit. If they're parents that don't talk to strangers, don't go somewhere with somebody, they still retain that. So then it becomes a process of assurance that moving into light is something they can do and something they should do, as opposed to just staying where they are, which a lot of kids who pass away through violence, they just stay there.
Yeah.
They don't know where to go. And if you're not learning an experience about the difference between here and there, there being higher consciousness, you won't know where to go. Now, flipping back to adults, middle-aged people, older people before that we age out into death, it's all about coming to grips with who you are. And not ignoring your spiritual side or your potential to experience spirit, which creates that box. It's framing.
Yeah.
We need to get out of the box. We need to create a new paradigm of our personal reality. Psychologists call this cognitive reframing.
Yeah.
We reframe our cognition to allow us to engage and move in different directions. And different behaviors.
And
sometimes it's just orientation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Facing south when you really want to face north, it doesn't invalidate you because you're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
It's just a course correction in your life.
Yep. Yeah. And I think, number one, I think we as a society tend to put way too much on ourselves. We tend to have this almost superhuman expectation of not making mistakes and just being human.
I have a different look at that. To me, it's about where are we living? We're living on Earth. Where is the foundation of life on Earth? Which is you have to eat and you have to sleep. You don't have to do a lot of other things. You need to do those. If you can't eat, you will die.
Yeah.
If you can't sleep, you'll become disoriented. So the primary goal in life is to eat. We are predators. People don't like to look at that side of themselves. We have been born into a predator world. We are predators. So it's about the rule of survival. Even on a very mundane aspect where people are not violent and not actively engaged in surviving, they understand that they have to survive.
Yeah.
You have to do those fundamental things to stay here. So we come into this world as predators. It's a hard one, but I finally got it one day. We come in as predators because that's who we are on the planet. Not in spirit, but on the planet Earth. In the realm of time and space, we have restrictions. We have necessities. And if we don't comply with those restrictions and necessities, we will not survive.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, it's learning that delicate balance that it takes with the world around you and what you do that helps us survive. And once again, yeah, without those coping mechanisms, I can see how it would be hard for somebody to make peace with moving forward and why they would get stuck and need help from somebody like yourself, Kevin, moving into the light.
Life is our trainer. Life will train us whether we like it or not. Life has its own pattern of existence that trains into our pattern of existence, and it's unavoidable. We, in life, you continue to need and want and desire. And until that pattern of want, need, and desire has been reframed, you'll continue to do what you do.
Yep.
Whatever your intentions are, whatever your good feelings about people are, whatever nice things you've done, if you don't refrain your take or your how you deal with life, you will be forever stuck in a pattern of failure. And I mean spiritual failure.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a hard thing to say, spiritual failure. So then you die. You go learn more. You go to the light for a reason. A lot of it's retraining, healing, taking a look at who you truly are. And then coming back, if you so choose to come back, and experiencing those things again. And that's karma. That's the brutal fact of karma. We become what we are. We become what our decisions are or how we behave.
Yeah. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And
you're not really the karma unless you achieve a state of unity with spirit that I call grace. When we find a period of grace, then we're released from that. Or release from karma.
And so what does it take does it take to find that state of grace? What does it take to, I guess, be open enough to experience it when it happens, Kevin?
Everyone's different. For some people it's prayer, some people it's meditation, some people it's good works. We all have our own way of embracing that. So it doesn't matter. You take this route, you take this route, you take that route. You're all heading to the destination of greater consciousness. And without a destination, you know what happens when you take a trip and you don't have a map? You end up God knows where.
Yeah.
And doing strange things. You need the map. And how do we find the map? Introspection, self-review, having quiet moments in our life where we can take in and send out.
Yeah. As you said earlier, that true and harsh personal review, being willing not to hold any punches with yourself.
You have to fool yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is kind of, it's interesting, the psychological want to do that. The want of self-confirmation, it's literally what leads to, biases, all kinds of things. It's strange how just our want of confirmation of our own feelings and information will lead us down the wrong path.
Because we're good in a certain direction.
Yeah.
If you're going in that direction without change, without self-examination, you will just continue to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Kevin, I want to thank you for your time today. This has been a fantastic conversation. I'd love to have you on again to explore these things and explore stuff deeper. Let everybody know. I mean, I've been popping up your website, things like that, but let everybody know where they can go to follow you, to keep up with everything on the pattern, where they can go to contact you for help.
I would, now from my experience, I'd just rather stay who I am. Yeah. I keep learning and experiencing many of these things that we've been talking about. It took 20, 30 years to get to that point where I could experience it. The pattern, the actual manifestation of the pattern is less than 10 years old. That happened one day when I was meditating in my favorite meditation chair through 3 o'clock in the morning. That's okay. I don't need sleep. When I experienced fully full impact, head on collision with the pattern. And it became emotionally embedded in me. I could not talk about it for months. And when it came time to talk about it in a book, I almost felt physically ill because the experience was so intimate, so personal, and so special to me. And I don't know if I really should have felt that way about it. I don't know. Is that describing it became a great difficulty for me, writing about it. I had to call up people I knew that have known me for years and say, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And so after I did a lengthy period of self-check-in, I just said the heck with it. What came true is what came true. It is what it is. It's not what it's not. Let it go. So then I started writing about it. And it felt better. And it took it out of the realm of an intimate personal experience, which is not definable. There's no quantitative aspect to it, into a more open expression of the experience, which made it okay.
Sure. Sure. And overall, part of what Spirit wants you to do to begin with.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the core of it. We are here to go. We are here to lead. And how long are we here until we leave? It's up to us. Some people go fast and some people go pretty darn slow.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, once again, I prefer
to speed it up, Chris.
And I'm the same way. I try to give people as many tools as they can and as many facets to the jewel of reality that is out there. That is one reason why I wanted to chat with you after Michelle proffered you up as a guest and I went and got your book. I was like, wow, this is really fascinating, because it is something that we talk about regularly on this show, but not in the concept of how it relates to the afterlife. And how it relates to becoming one with the light. Very important conversations. And once again, I would love to have you on again and again to crack this nut a little bit more and dig deeper into this topic, Kevin.
Well, choose a topic and I'd be happy to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time today. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you are online, checking out everything from Kevin Jeffers over at thepattern.pub. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can find all of the episodes. That is where you can follow us on social media. That is where you can visit the store and find all of not only our merchandise, but books from our guests like The Pattern. All you do is click the book. It'll take you straight to the store to purchase it. So thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in every week. Thank you so much for your continued support. I will be back live in the studio very soon, talking with the good folks from the Texas Myths and Legends conference. It's going to be super fun. That's coming up in Cibolo, Texas. We will be out there live. So looking forward to that. Until next time, folks, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.